and welcome to Season 2, Episode 1 of The Coriolis Effect. A better world, a world without sin. I'm Dave.
And I'm Matthew. And I'm not entirely sure I'm ready for this world without sin. I mean, I know we were quite sinful in the last series, but, you know, I quite like a lot of sin.
I'm so not sure it's being...
Do we have to?
Well, I think what we need to do is just pretend it's a world without sin, and behind the scenes we do what we like, and everyone thinks we're really, really, you know...
You mean sort of like the church does?
Okay, before we make this this podcast a complete rant about religious double standards. Anyway, moving swiftly on.
Yes. Let's move on.
So what have we got lined up for today then, Matt?
What we've got lined up for today, we've got some highlights from the world of gaming, as usual. We thought for the second part of our How to Play series, having discussed group concepts last time, that you and I would have a bit of a chat about actually creating characters and what we've learned with our various players creating characters and, of course, creating characters for each other's campaigns over the last few months.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be quite interesting, probably a bit free-form conversation. I don't think we've really thought about what we're going to say, but just a chance to talk about our impressions, really.
Don't look at the man behind the curtains. Of course, we have carefully scripted that conversation and prepared it with lots of revision. You have actually scripted and prepared and recorded an essay on our faction of the episode, which is this time the Legion, which surely must have been the most boring faction we could find in the book.
I think the problem was scratching my head about what we're going to do, and I thought, "Ha ha! I'm using the Legion now. Much more. My brain is not working today. God, I haven't really got going. But I'm using them much more. Okay, I'm going
to. So you mean to say this? You mean to say this isn't a better world at all? This is actually a slightly less prepared world with maybe more sin than in season one.
Well, this is just the onset of early dementia, clearly, where I can't even think of a simple word, even though I've tried twice to think of it. Anyway, I'm using the Legion a lot more in Spectral Corsair campaign. And so I thought, this would be an easy one to look at and do an essay for the podcast. And then I thought, oh God, they're a bit boring, aren't they? But we'll see. I have had a bit of a think, and I think I've come up with something which perhaps proves they're not as boring as they might seem at first glance.
Smashing. Well, I'll test you on that, and we'll see how much discussion we get out of your essay at the end, and that will show us how interesting they really turn out to be. Then my essay for this episode is a new ship. So we'll be talking about the Black Sheep, Portal Hopper, later in the programme. And then you've got an update. And I'm a bit surprised by this. I thought you were going to take a rest, but you've already launched the next season, as it were, of your Spectral Corsair campaign.
Yes. So the guys had no desire to slow down or not play anymore, play different characters.
Or do anything else.
Or play something else. Not that I really asked them, actually, but we just carried on and everyone was happy with that. So we've now taken another slightly different tack, which I will talk about the first scenario later on.
Brilliant. And I've got some news from a nascent group that might well be forming around my friendly local gaming shop. And then I think, since I didn't set you any homework and you ended up doing that really boring assignment of the Legion, we have to remember...
We're really talking up
me some homework.
This one, aren't we? boring. It's going to be boring. Don't listen to the Legion bit. It's boring.
Don't even bother listening to this episode. No, do bother listening to the episode. It isn't as boring as we're making it out to be.
Well, let's hope not, anyway. Time will tell.
Well, I've had a bit of a preview of your essay, and I actually think you've hit on some really interesting stuff. So, shall we crack on?
Let's crack on. World of gaming.
Do you remember when we were at Dragon Meet, you, me and Tony were in the bar having, I guess, a beer. They were quite expensive beers, so we might have been having a tap water. I can't remember. And then a colleague of mine from work appeared. And it's one of those situations where you kind of go, no, I know who you are, but you're in entirely the wrong place. And so yes. I'm really confused.
Yes, I do remember. Yeah.
And she explained that she felt she was really confused as well, because she felt she was in the wrong place, because she isn't a gamer. She'd only turned up with her partner, who is into tabletop, and his name was Pete. And he mentioned that he was about to launch a new game. And that
remember,
RPG is called Triumvine, and it's on Kickstarter now.
Yeah, excellent. I don't know anything about it. What's the genre?
Right. Well, I'm not entirely sure, except to say that there are three planes, and so I think in a way there's a bit of a choice between three genres.
Okay.
There's a golden plane, which seems to be quite high magic fantasy. There's a middle plane, for want of a better word, which seems to be kind of steampunky, industrial revolutionary sort of thing. And then there's a lower plane, which is kind of like our world. But whether it's our world now or historical, I'm not entirely sure. And I think the campaign involves travelling, you know, creating characters from each of those planes in your party, and the campaign sort of takes you between all three of them.
Right.
Now, it's interestingly, he makes quite a bold statement that it's a kind of... It emphasises non-combat conflict rather
right.
than combat
okay.
in the system. And in fact, he's created a sort of generic system that sits alongside called the Imperial System. And this is a setting, but the two could be split out, and I guess you could play the setting with your D&D 5e rules if you wanted to. Or you could use the Imperial System to create your own world. But it is, you know, the emphasis is on finding other solutions to conflict other than combat. Although I think it still lets you hit people with swords if that's your thing. I haven't played it. I can't say whether it's any good. I think we've been invited to maybe have an online game with Peter if we'd like. So
okay.
maybe we should consider that. I don't think we could get that in before the end of the Kickstarter, because there's only a couple of weeks of that left to go.
Right.
I did back it.
I was going to say, did you back it? Okay, cool.
Yeah, well, you know, I did back it because when a mate from work turns up at Dragon Meet, you kind of feel beholden to them, don't you? But I wasn't really looking for a new RPG to play now, but I felt I ought to get in on the ground floor with this one. I've only backed it at PDF level. I'm not sure that I'm ready to make a commitment in hardback, but that's definitely an interesting looking concept to watch.
Okay, well, I'll go and have a look at it. So I hadn't heard about that one before.
Else that I definitely decided against backing is something that I think you have backed.
The Crusader Kings board game. Absolutely. I backed that the minute I saw it, actually. I'm not sure whether my brain's playing tricks on me or not, but I know we've talked about this before, and I can't remember whether we talked about it actually on air or not. So apologies if I'm just repeating myself. But this board game is the secret project that Nils and Costa mentioned to us when we were in Sweden last year. I'm guessing it was, because they were talking about a board game. And it's exactly the kind of thing that I've been looking for in board games. So Crusader Kings 2 is a computer game. It's about sort of medieval empire building and sort of generational game, whereby you play your family and then your family have to marry, and then you go and try and conquer places. And so the game that I've played on the computer that's very similar was Medieval Total War, which is very, very similar concept. But I've never played Crusader Kings on the computer.
Oh, have you not?
No.
Ah.
So, but Medieval Total War, or the first version of Medieval Total War, I think is very, very similar, or it's got all the same elements that I really love. So it's got things like your dynasty building, where you will try and marry off your children or your family members, and then they will have children and they will become your next generation of leaders, and then your leaders will die, and they'll die in battle or they'll die in their bed. But the idea of having this as a board game, and having had a quick look at the way they've seems to have put it together, they seem to really have got the. I haven't played it. Obviously, I haven't had a chance to do that. I didn't get to the expo a couple of weeks ago, unfortunately, where I think they were demoing it a little bit. Yeah. But it seems to have all those really good, interesting elements of the strategy computer game, and put it through into a board game. So I backed that straight away. I think the Kickstarter is just about to finish. They've unlocked 20 stretch goals, I think. So it's done very, very well indeed, as you'd expect. Again, it looks excellent. So really looking forward to seeing that, and it will be a little while before we get it. But yeah.
Yeah, excellent. Now I have played the computer game, and I really like it. Actually, it's not a game that I feel I'm any good at. It's one that takes a long time. I'm always rushing my decisions. It's kind of the ideal computer game that I wish I had when I was at university and had more time.
Yeah.
And I know I'm at university again now, but I'm doing that part-time and I'm doing a job. And
a podcast.
And that means you generally have less time. And also...
And having a family and a life.
Your first years at university, you waste time. I remember playing Civilization at one point and thinking, oh, just about time for half an hour Civilization before bed. And then...
6 hours later.
Looking up a moment later and going, what's that strange light in the room? Oh, it's the morning.
I've been there, done that.
So I would have done that with Crusader Kings if it had been around at the time. It's really complex. It's really, it's a great game. I know you'd enjoy it, definitely.
Mm.
And it's worth, I will say, it's worth downloading it if you've got any time at all to spare. And I was initially quite interested by Crusader Kings. I thought, oh, all of the fun of Crusader Kings, but it doesn't take hours to play. But actually, of course, it does take hours, doesn't it? Like any board game with that sort of complexity, it's a 3 or 4 hour long game, I think.
Yeah, probably.
And in the end, I think reason got the better of me. And I thought, look, I've got a copy of the Game of Thrones board game that I have never played. I've got Firefly Adventures, which I was very excited about. I've played once.
Yeah, long. I've got that as well, and I've played it once or twice. And after
you've got the Firefly board game.
Okay, this
again,
is different.
That takes a long time. Firefly Adventures is a kind of skirmish game that just came out a few months ago. But again, I played that once.
Yeah.
I played the board game a couple of times, but you're right, that takes a long time.
It takes ages, and you get to the point where you're just willing your opponents to complete their missions so the game can end, which is a bit of a pity.
I've got Fury of Dracula, which I played twice. I haven't got time, and I haven't got a family. I've got a mate called Chris who has a family who all sort of sit round the table every night and play a board game.
Yeah.
But my family won't do that, so...
No. My boys do that. My sons do. Jenny used to, but she doesn't really get the time so much anymore or have the inclination, which in one way is a good thing because she's brilliant at these sort of strategy games. And also very competitive. So,
so you'd lose if she did play.
So she wins a lot, and then she gets upset when she doesn't win. So, yeah.
But, well, my wife really, really, really doesn't like games of any sort. I mean, Scrabble, I think she'll go for. But almost everything else, she doesn't like.
You do need to invest an afternoon or an evening to get through some of these games, and I find the investment of the time is usually worth it. It's not for everybody.
Yeah, and when we get together, you know, we get together so rarely, we want to play one of our many long ongoing campaigns of one of our role-playing games.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure we'd all enjoy playing any one of these games, but at the cost of not taking the story forward in one of the others. So that's not for me, but I'm really glad you've invested in it. Maybe at some point we'll get to play that one together.
Yeah, I think maybe we should, yeah. I'm still waiting for the Nemesis board game that I kicked in for. I'm not sure. I think I've done the pledge manager thing. So I think it should be on its way relatively soon. Which is the one that's effectively taking Alien and making it into a board game. So that sounds
quite
fun. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
Well, cool. Talking of delivery of things that people have backed. One of the things that I saw came out either first thing this morning or yesterday was for backers of the Emissary Lost campaign, the novella Dark Between the Stars.
Yes, I saw that, yeah.
Did you read that?
I haven't read that one, I don't think. I've read...
Oh, it's interesting. I mean, I feel a bit cheated because I actually paid good money to Amazon for a Kindle version of the original publication of that. But it's a lovely read, actually. It adds depth. As if we needed any more depth to the world of Fertilizer. It does actually add depth. And there's some great little turns of phrase in it. It's written by Matthias
Lilja.
And if you're not paying for it, if you're a backer for Emissary Lost, get to reading that. Yeah. It's great fun.
Yeah, I will.
Anything? Yeah, just another bit of World of Gaming, I guess. Tomorrow, it will be too late for those of you listening to this program. But
tomorrow is Friday. Saturday the 16th, isn't it? So, or
yes.
17th.
And on Saturday the 16th, it is Free RPG Day.
Yes.
Do you have a friendly local game store that you're going to visit on that day?
No, we don't. There isn't one very near here. There's a Games Workshop shop in Stevenage, which is a little way off. But no, I don't really.
Yeah, but
the hobby shop that was here closed. Probably a decade ago. So, no, we're sadly lacking in this neck of the woods, actually.
Ah, well, something to think about for our retirement, eh?
How sad of that
but
be.
Yeah, I've got a friendly local game store. I'm going to be running Unknown Armies there tomorrow afternoon. Mm. And cool. Some of the loot that's come out looks quite interesting. There's a sort of preview quick start version of the new Warhammer 40k role-playing game called Wrath and Fury, I think.
Yeah.
There's a Cthulhu Confidential, which is a one-to-one.
Yep.
Remember we play-tested Cthulhu Confidential?
Yes, I do remember. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, there's a little freebie sort of quick start version of that.
Yeah, cool.
Which looks quite nice. And I'm running. In fact, I've already got my loot because my local game store gave me a copy early, since I'm running it tomorrow afternoon. It would have been a pretty tough ask to give it to me in the morning and run it by the end. The Unknown Armies Quick Start is a lovely little package, and I thoroughly recommend it, particularly to people who've never quite got Unknown Armies, because this is a really well-written scenario that kind of takes you from the normal world of a sort of police procedural into the weirdness of playing, as they call it, broken people conspiring to fix the world in a relatively smooth way. And
yeah, I mean, I've heard you talk quite a lot. Yeah, I've heard you talk quite a lot about Unknown Armies, but even from all of that, I still don't really have a clear concept in my mind of what the game is all about. So maybe that might be something I'll pick up.
Yeah.
Yeah,
or
good.
Maybe I tell you what, we could potentially run it at some point.
Yeah, absolutely.
During our weekend in Norfolk this year.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's enough about the rest of the world of gaming. Shall we get into some actual Coriolis content?
Let's get into some actual Coriolis content, and we are going to have a little discussion about character creation, aren't we?
Yeah.
So what do you want to say about character creation? So listeners,
well,
you now realise that
we've come
to a totally unscripted
creation.
Part of the episode.
Yes, but well-prepared part of the episode. We've spent hours poring in depth over the character creation rules, haven't we?
We have done a lot of character creation, yeah.
Yes, over the years. Not necessarily in advance of this conversation.
No, I was just going to say, I think the thing for me, again, that is a real strength is the collaborative approach to player character generation for the group. So obviously you're pushed to think about that right at the start when you're choosing your group concept, but then the character creation itself has elements that forces you to hook in with the other players, like your PC buddy, for example. Despite some of my misgivings on some of that, which I remember saying about a year ago. For those who haven't heard it, I can't remember which episode it was, but one of the first.
Yeah, you did go on a rant about, I don't want to have a buddy. I want to make my buddy in play.
Yeah, which I think is fair enough.
And to be fair, I know exactly where you're coming from, because I think in the last couple of years, I have become less interested in creating a detailed background for my character at generation stage. And I much prefer, I'm finding, systems that give you relatively light character creation, and then you build up your character's background as you play.
Yes, I agree. And I think also I do very much like the element where in some games, and I think Fate is a really good example of this, where the other players influence your character, the background and the likes and dislikes of your character and what you're good at. I think that's a really interesting, because one thing I find with a lot of games is that the random element is taken out of your character generation. So if I was playing me when I say turned 18, you know, I'm presented with me at 18, if you see what I mean. So there are things that have happened in my life that I didn't choose. There are things that didn't happen in my life that I would perhaps like to have done. And I think some games, you can choose your perfect character. And actually, I quite like the old traditional element where you would roll some dice to decide what your stats were. You wouldn't be given the option to fiddle them around too much. And you actually can end up with something that you don't like about your character, but it's all part of playing that character. Yeah, you know, you have to manage.
You make the best of what you're given.
Yeah, and I think some modern, certainly a lot of modern games or recent games in the last 10 or 15 years give you too much latitude to say, I want to choose a cybernetic soldier with strength of X and a dexterity of Y, and he's going to be a bit dysfunctional in social situations. Rather than rolling it up and seeing what the dice give you. And there needs to be a balance between the two, I think. But I do very much like letting the dice dictate your character's, your character a little bit, at least, up to the point where you go, right, I'm playing this character now.
Yeah. I mean, I think I still love Traveller character generation.
Mm. Me too.
For giving you a character that is nothing like your first original concept. But I can understand, people who want to roleplay might well have an idea of the sort of character they want to roleplay. And so this tends, this system that we have in the Coriolis system is mostly choosing. But there are a couple of random things I quite like. And as you say, it's designed to be done round the table in a session zero with the rest of your players.
Yeah.
So you're all creating characters together. And I think there, you've got to have a simple system. Robin Laws talks about character generation as homework. And if you imagine some of the systems, what we have played in the past, I'm thinking especially Aces and Eights. If you want to use the full character creation system there, it takes bloody hours.
Yes.
Yeah. It's fun. I really enjoyed it. I loved rolling all those random tables and discovering the character I was. But it, you couldn't possibly do that with everybody else, particularly if you're all sharing one book, because, you've got a bunch of options to choose as well as the random things. And, you're sitting there while somebody's making complex calculations to work out what their to hit rate is or bonus or whatever.
Yeah.
A lot of old style character creation systems had to be done at home. And if you want to do it around the table, it's got to be relatively simple. And this one is relatively simple.
Yeah.
The first choice it gives you is one that I'm not convinced I like.
Okay.
And that's I think they call it Origin. It's where you choose whether you're First Come or Zenithian.
Yep.
Now, I have a little bit of a problem with the fact that, as we've played, we've built our understanding of what the First Come and the Zenithians are. In fact, this has zero mechanical effect on your character. they talk about how the First Camp and the Zenithians have merged and inter, you know, and some First Camp becomes Zenithian and vice versa. I kind of feel that's a choice that we could well be making later in the game, when we when it's important maybe to ally yourself with one faction or the other.
Yeah.
To start off with that one, I'm feeling, you know, it doesn't really help you place your character at all. Unlike the next choice you make, which is about the sort of upbringing.
I'm going to slightly stationary or privileged. Yeah, I'm going to slightly disagree with you, I think, on that point. So,
well, go ahead, you fucker. Go ahead, my learned friend.
Because obviously I'm right. Shut up. The thing with the origin, for me, basically says where you've come from. It doesn't necessarily, and it, well, unless as a player you've decided I really want to be a Zelosian, or I really want to be in the consortium, where it's kind of obvious where your heritage will have, you know, where you come from.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is just like you don't have to stick with that as part of your character. So you could easily be a Zenithian. You know, you say that I was on, you know, my family was on the Zenith. I've been living on Kua, say, or Coriolis even. But actually, I've chosen to follow the First Come ideology. So I don't think it sets... It's not like it's setting anything in stone. What it's doing is just telling you a bit of a story about where you've come from.
I'm not saying it's setting anything in stone. I just don't think it's necessarily the first decision we should be asking particularly new players to make.
Possibly. I see that, yeah, because I think... You know, there is so much stuff in the book, and if you are coming to it from not having played it before or not knowing much about it, the actual distinction between Zenithian and First Come is probably irrelevant at that point, or you just don't
know.
I'll be First Come. Okay, that sounds good, and then actually you realise that doesn't fit your character at all. But then that could be a nice twist, because then if you later on decide actually you much rather play a character who's got Zenithian ideals, then that gives you a little, perhaps a bit of conflict. You know, you're from a First Come family, but actually, you know, you're the black sheep because you want to follow Zenithian principles. Don't know.
Exactly. You know, I think that is a choice, that as you discover more about the universe and, you know, and your fellow players, then you might go, oh, you know, all my players are First Come. I'm going to be the Zenithian grit in the team.
Yeah.
That might well be, you know, an interesting choice to make. Or you go, oh, I've got this fascinating history I've built up here. I want to be the opposite to what my parents are so that I can have that conflict within myself. That's all good stuff. But as I say, as the first thing you do, it feels to me that it's not a choice I'd be making at this point in the role-playing.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's fine to roll... the, you know, of the planets you come from, that's fine, and that might give you a hint as to what you are. But let's face it, if you roll on a random allocation of your home system and you get Zalos, then really
you're kind of stuck a bit, aren't you? And actually, I'm
less worried about the choosing your home planet at this stage in the game. It might well be a bit of an anchor in the enormous realm of possibilities that the Third Horizon offers. But in my heart of hearts, I think as I've come to know the Third Horizon better, I'd have stuck that towards the end of character creation rather than at the beginning. But
perhaps. I also think actually the home system thing, which only gives you the main systems, even though if you roll a six, it says choose. I would suggest just go straight to page 301, I think it is, and roll on the system list. Because why shouldn't you come from one of the other systems? Why should you have
I guess the
population centres are in those big systems, but there are people all over the horizon. So for a player character, you know, if you're doing some kind of population topographical study or something and you're randomly rolling, then yes, favour the big systems. But if you're just choosing where your character comes from, they can come from anywhere. Why not roll on the big table and end up coming from Rigel or from Zib or something. That might be interesting.
Yes.
You could be the, you could be the little country hat, the old country hick coming to the big city lights kind of thing.
Well, precisely. Actually, you know, I do think in terms of introducing people to Coriolis, I'd love to do some sort of introductory adventure where you are newcomers to this amazing city in the stars that the Coriolis station is. So that would be fun. I think they've probably gone for those five systems that they choose there in a sort of in a nod to the complexity of the horizon for new players. So it's kind of saying,
Yeah, well, you could choose. Yeah.
But you know, just to give you a few simple handles, you know, do you want to come from Zalos? Okay, it's kind of you're like a guy from Warhammer 40K, or De Baron, you're an Arab. You know, and there's a few clues there that are easy to get your head around if you're new to the game. But again, I'm not convinced that that's the first, that's where I'd start character creation. Whereas the upbringing bit, which you choose, and that's interesting, the way they say, you know, here's a way to randomly roll your home system, but then you choose your upbringing is I think kind of interesting, but for me that makes more sense as where to start with character creation, where you're going, do I want to be dirt poor, privileged, or somewhere in between?
Yeah, I'm not sure it makes a lot of difference really, but
yeah, but you're wrong, as I said earlier on.
Occasionally.
Moving on, here's an interesting thing that my guys were doing group concept. This is only that we had a little bit of a break in our session one. Our GM had to take a phone call, and one of the players said, "Oh, we could talk about group concept." So they talked about group concept, and I'll tell you what they concluded later on. Okay. But they pretty quickly got into choosing what their character concepts would be. So they've already jumped past the first two stages and have started thinking about the character concept without doing anything else at all. So I think, you know, that instinctively that came out of that group concept conversation.
Yeah, I think that's probably a really important point, because for most people, I think you come to a game with at least a vague idea of the kind of character you might want to play. And so actually you end up with a system like Coriolis, you end up saying, well, actually I want to be a data spider that, you know, is great at hacking or something. And then you actually go back through the process to sort of retrofit the rest of it to fit what you want your character to look like at the end. And that's fine. That's fine. It does possibly take away some of the random element that I was talking about before, but so be it, and it works. I think maybe I'm just getting a bit hung up on that random element a little bit, because I like to get hung up on really small, unimportant points, perhaps. But
yeah, well, there is a random element, but it's a random element I think you're not going to like that we'll come to in a few moments.
Go on, what's that random element then?
Well, of course, choosing your icon, or rather, drawing your icon from the deck of icon cards.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's just like saying when were you born, isn't it? I mean, so because it's effectively your star sign.
But it also gives you a talent.
Yeah. But I mean, my general kind of dislike of drawing cards over and above rolling a dice for randomizing things. Again, it's probably one of those little things I ought to get over and stop going on about. But it's.
I think it is. You know, yeah,
I'll have to bring it up with my therapist next time.
Count that as one of your sins, and let's see if this series can be without it.
One of my many, many sins.
Many sins.
Yes. Okay, I won't mention that again for the whole season.
This is a system that's about point allocation. You get different points depending on your upbringing, but they are few in number. So it's not one of those systems where you've got like 300 points and a million different options and you spend ages doing homework.
Yeah,
It is the sort of point allocation you can do round the table quite
easily. And that's
easily.
A real strength as well, I think, of the system, because it's really simple, but it doesn't feel stupidly simple. It feels complex enough, but it does what it needs to do without having to spend, like you say, several hours and some kind of math degree to work out where you're going to spend all your points.
Now, talking of math degree, though, some people despise min-maxes in games. I don't, actually. I think, you know, if your thing, the ludic element that you enjoy in any game is min-maxing and trying to break the system, then to my mind, that's part of playing the game. I might not like you as a person, but I'm not going to stop you from doing that. So here's a little quiz for you. Can you tell me what the min-maxer's first choice should be?
Presumably making one of your important stat 5 points rather than 4.
Now, before that even,
you
haven't got a clue, have you?
No,
I don't
really care either, actually, but go on.
Okay, well, this is advice to min-maxers out there. In terms of upbringing, if you're a min-maxer, you want to be a plebeian. You don't want to be stationary or privileged.
Yeah.
And why is that, Dave?
It's because you get more attribute points.
You do, and you can earn skill points in play, but you can't earn attribute points.
No, exactly.
But of course, it does give you less money to spend, and often min-maxers like lots of kit. I think, to be honest, that's the way they should go.
Yeah. I think, again, the system here does actually lend itself to a bit of kind of unconscious min-maxing, almost. And the reason I say that is, so Morgan's character in my campaign, Ajit, is a sniper and an agent. He's an assassin. And the stats he now has, having been playing him for a year and having had a really good start when he set up his character in the first place, he's going to be the best sniper in the whole Horizon. There'll be nobody better than
him.
Which is fine. I think you just have to recognise that you can reach that point relatively easily. And I wonder whether over the last year I've been slightly too generous in the amount of experience I've been giving out to the players in the games. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's a lesson for me.
Well, you are more generous than me, aren't you?
I am. I'm a generous GM. You know, and you're a horrible, miserly, evil GM. I was going to say something else there, but I thought better not. my end of
the relationship. Well, so basically what you've just admitted is I'm right to be miserly.
I think I could be more miserly and it wouldn't damage the game. It would benefit the game. So I think I am slightly overgenerous, but that's not a problem again, because I think the rate of character death is going to be quite high. So, you know, if you get a bit maxed out, you're not going to live for very long anyway, so why not enjoy it while you can, kind of thing.
I think that's fair. You know, I've got no problem with stereotypical. I don't know whether I mean stereotypical, but it's a word that'll do. With, if you like, one-dimensional characters. You know, movies are full of guys who are the best sniper you've ever seen.
Yes.
And hopefully play will bring out some nuance in that. But if they start off as pretty close to being the best sniper they've ever seen, why not? If that's what a character, that's what a player wants to play. You know, I used to have a character. It was Andy Gibbs used to have a character in Traveller who, through random generation, was pretty much the best pilot you've ever seen.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And
is that Biggles?
He was fabulous. Biggles, exactly.
Yeah. Jeremiah Biggles,
that was his name, yeah. And, you know, I had no problem playing alongside him. I wasn't going to try and compete with him on piloting skills because I was a businessman of some sort. Anyway, I don't have a problem with that sort of
I don't remember stereotypical what character. My character was in that campaign. Was that the one where I was the Cuban mercenary? Ferdinand Rodriguez.
Now, if he was Jeremiah Biggles, I was Jacob Trevelyan.
Yes,
and
it would have been Ferdinand Rodriguez was the Cuban mercenary. Yeah. With lots of cybernetic arms and legs. Yeah, there might have been a bit of min-maxing going on there as well, actually. But anyway,
we were teenagers. Min-maxing was all the rage.
Yeah. I was young, you know. I was, you know, inexperienced, and he was tough. So anyway, yeah.
The other thing you briefly wanted to talk about, was reputation.
Yes, I know we've mentioned reputation before, but we were just talking before we started to record, and you know, I commented that I don't use it at all, not through any conscious decision. As a GM, I don't use it at all. It just kind of never comes up. It just feels almost like certainly in the games that I'm running, which are trading, exploring, quite a lot of fighting, but there is some negotiation going on. It just kind of feels like a rule that's unnecessary. So I just haven't really worried about it. I know that in the Mukfar campaign, you did, I think, use reputation as a modifier at one point, didn't you?
Yeah, I needed to use reputation because you were getting so many successes in your manipulation roles. No,
it makes a nice change.
I was already using reputation, but despite the reputation bonus, or reputation modifiers, I should say, that I was giving you were still getting loads of successes. So I can see how it works mechanically, but there is a thing about the story world where I think reputation is going to be a far more important mechanic in the upcoming Forbidden Lands campaign. And I'm not convinced that it is well-placed here in the Third Horizon. I know what they're trying to get. You know, they are trying to have this idea of diplomacy and
social
really
standing
powerful
and stuff.
Characters and yeah. Social standing. But as we've said before, and I won't bore our listeners with this one, the Third Horizon is big. I mean, really big. I mean, you might think it's a long way down to the chemist.
Yeah.
But given the population
just
of the Third Horizon.
To the Third Horizon.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm not convinced that most of our player characters would have a reputation that registers at all on the scale of this world that we're in.
And I think it's so situational as well. So, you know, I think we said before that you know you've got there will be people who in a particular relationship where reputation would really matter, and then it wouldn't matter for anybody else at all. So actually, it wouldn't matter if it was the most you know highfalutin, powerful bureaucrat from the spire in Coriolis telling somebody something. If they've got no kind of position or authority over them, they say, well, I don't give a monkeys you've got a reputation of 8, I'm going to do what I like, bug off. So I think it's so I don't feel, for me anyway, as a GM, that the game has lost anything by me leaving out the reputation bonuses. Yeah, but each to their own. But yeah, I mean, we've talked about it before, so maybe we should leave it there for now.
So I think the only thing, or there are two things then, we're kind of coming, you know, we've made our stats, we've chosen who we are, we've got our buddy relationships, and I know you've got a bit of a problem with choosing your buddy relationships this early in the game, and I can sort of understand that, and also choosing your problem this early. And I like the fact that in things like Forbidden Worlds, they've kind of said, well, you know, start off with one now, but you can change it later. And they could make that more explicit in this one. I think all our listeners can take that, although it isn't explicit in this book, do take that advice from the creators of this and other games that make those decisions.
I think for me, you just need to use that as a guide to the kind of conversations you want to be having or the kind of things you want to be thinking about, rather than have it as a definitive, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, you know, otherwise you haven't done your character properly. No, just use it as an opportunity to think, is there a relationship here actually I can have with somebody else in the group that I want, that would naturally be a PC buddy kind of thing? You don't have to choose the PC buddy if you don't want to. And also on the problem thing, most of my players, maybe not most, but some of them at least, have changed their problem during the campaign because the original one they chose wasn't didn't really cut it. It wasn't adding very much to the game. And there's a couple of them who haven't changed their problems yet, but I might encourage them to think about it, where the problems haven't really manifested themselves. So again, Morgan's character has got indebted as his problem. So he's got great big debts. I haven't yet found out a way of really drawing that into the game in a way that I thought would be really interesting. Similarly, 8-bit, Sebastian Fenwick character, Paul's character, has effectively got an Ijma Earth license out against him. And again, I haven't found the right way to introduce that yet. I've thought about trying to a couple of times, but again, it just doesn't add much to kind of the action that's going on already. So they're not very interesting. So I might find some way of having those change and have them become problems that are more readily role-playable, because those ones are quite difficult to role-play.
Yeah, but, so I think our overall advice is actually maybe you don't need to sort those out around the table unless there's a really obvious one.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when there's a really obvious one, it is hopefully going to start setting out what might well be the storyline of the campaign.
Yeah, so, completely, yeah.
You know, if they had said, oh, we're wanting to be Han Solo running away from Jabba the Hutt, then obviously being in debt, you know, might be a really useful problem. But
yes,
that's not the way that the group as a whole went. So, maybe play a session or two before you feel you need to start thinking about what your problems and who your buddies are.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good advice.
The thing that I think that takes the time when you're around the table and you're all doing this together is choosing that one talent. You only get to choose one talent. I mean, the group will choose their group talent. You get given your astrological talent, as it were, your icon talent. But unless you're a humanite, you only have to choose one other one. But I think actually that might take more time around the table.
Yeah, I mean, that, like you said, that's probably the most time-consuming part of this particular character generation system. But compared to others, it's actually still really quick and swift. And quite often, players have an idea by then of the kind of thing they're after, and it's quite easy to choose one quite quickly.
And I guess the other thing that you might well leave until you've left the table is going through all the equipment lists and spending your cash on equipment. Which
that's the most time-consuming thing, actually, for character generation, because the way they've laid out the equipment lists is a bit rubbish.
It's dreadful.
It's one of the few criticisms of Coriolis as a game is their equipment lists are just absolutely shocking, just very difficult to use, just because they've split them up by kind of equipment theme, and you then have to go through, am I in the right theme? Am I on the right... So, if they're going to do a reprint, do the equipment lists differently. Make them alphabetical. Be much easier.
Yes.
Anyway.
I agree. In fact, I don't want to see necessarily that in a reprint, although a reprint would be lovely, but actually I'd almost like to see some sort of 3D PDF player supplement that we could hand out and people could go home and do that for homework.
Yes, because that's good thought, yeah.
You know, I mean, okay, if they come to the table and everybody's got, a particular device that the group only really needs one of, well, that's an easy thing to solve, you know, before play. But that sort of thing, I think, isn't really adding anything to it. And to be honest, what I like about the system is they do give you, as part of the core concept, some basic equipment choices to make so you can start playing straight
away.
That's
good, I like that.
And you don't need to.
No.
But there is a thing with science fiction gaming, I think, where people do like to spend a bit of time buying some kit. That's part of what science fiction gaming's about.
Yeah,
and
very much so.
So if we're going to facilitate that, I think some sort of little supplement with, as you say, reorganized equipment lists and some slightly better descriptions as well in some of them. I feel with some of those bits of equipment, they've cut down the words from, or maybe in Swedish, it all makes more sense.
Yeah,
but there are definitely a couple of things there that the English description still leaves you asking questions of, well, what is it actually doing?
Yeah.
So I'd like to see a little player's supplement that could have those in, and ideally, as I say, something that as GMs we could give them away.
Sounds like a good idea. Oh, and the one thing the book does have is some nice pictures of some of the guns that they talk about. The kind of things that Legion soldiers might possibly use. And I wonder if people are spotting my obvious segue. I took a little bit of homework to look at the Legion, and let's listen to the musings that I came up with. I believe in something greater than myself. A better world. A world without sin. I'm not going to live in that world. There's no place for me there. I'm a monster. What I do is evil. I have no illusions about it, but it must be done. The best must die, so the rest can live. The Legion, on the face of it, seems a really run-of-the-mill, stereotypical bunch of bad guys. They are, in fact, a first-come faction, but are such a young faction and are so closely allied with the Consortium that, to all intents and purposes, they are considered to be Zenithian. Many say that the two factions should just merge, but the Legion would then have to relinquish their priceless seat on the Coriolis Council. But behind this veil of simplicity, the faction might be hiding layers of nuance that could energise an exciting Coriolis campaign. The Legion is seen as the military arm of the Consortium, as such it is, but it's more than that as well. They are a faction in their own right that simply allies itself with the Consortium, as they are natural bedfellows. Obvious brothers and sisters in arms, with much the same outlook on life in the Third Horizon, a Zenithian one. With many of the same enemies, the Order of the Pariah and Nomad Federation to count just two, with the same interests at heart, and both benefiting from their joint ventures. But perhaps this simplistic stereotype masks a more complicated relationship, one that is fractured and weak and balanced on the edge of a knife. And maybe this balance is threatened by the inequalities in the relationship between the two. The Legion has the military capability, the cutting edge, the deus ex machina. The Consortium has the trade, the money, the economic weight. Does the Consortium even have any military strength it would call its own? Do they have any power, any force of arms whatsoever, without the Legion by their side? And on the other hand, does the Legion have any economy of its own? How does it pay its way, if not for the retainers given it by the Consortium? Are they two factions forever entwined in a symbiotic dance that neither can survive without? So are they, in fact, just one faction? It is for you to answer those questions. But what this shows is that perhaps the Legion isn't quite such a straightforward and run-of-the-mill faction as it may seem at first glance. And perhaps this Legion-Consortium relationship is much more complicated than it seems. You could imagine that the Consortium is a restraining influence on the warmongering tendencies of the Legion, who, without this calming touch, would be much more willing to flex their muscles and bully their way around the Third Horizon. Might is right, as the saying sometimes has it. But might doesn't always lead to favourable trade conditions and preferential commercial relationships. So does the Consortium feel uncomfortable by this alliance of convenience? And do they feel it's better to keep their friends close and their enemies closer? Have they in fact overreached themselves and now find that they are holding the Legion Tiger by the tail, just waiting for it to turn and bite back? And how does the Legion feel about all this? Yes, it may be a symbiotic relationship, but the faction that holds the purse strings holds the real power, doesn't it? Perhaps the Legion's leadership is growing tired of the Consortium telling them what to do, where to go, who to fight, and how to die. Chafing under the yoke of these arrogant bureaucrats, men and women safe in the knowledge that while they make the deals and earn the rich rewards, their strong-arm lackeys are quietly waiting to be told what to do, tugging their forelocks in respect and deferring to their betters. And let's not forget that the Legion is actually a first-come faction that's turned its back on their first-come ideals. And they must be a pariah to all other first-come factions in the Third Horizon for betraying their ideology and turning their heretical backs on the icons. Surely there must be factions within the Legion itself. The relationship with the Consortium aside, that feel drawn to the iconic ideals of their first come ancestors, and regret, or perhaps even hate, the direction the Legion has taken. Maybe there are powers within the Legion looking to correct the historic mistakes that have tied them so closely to the Zenithian heresy, and dream of the day when the Legion throws off these unbelievers and embraces the Icons once again. So perhaps it is time for the worm to turn. Maybe it's time for the real strength of the Legion to step forward and take control. Maybe it's time for the pampered and soft-skinned merchants who think themselves so powerful, so patrician, so inviolable, to be taught a lesson in humility at the end of a Legion barrel. But who knows if the trader barons of the Consortium are blind to this burning ember of resentment, or if they've sensed the change in the wind and are readying themselves for it.
Well, as it turns out, not as boring as I was expecting. It's interesting. I think you and I did have the same thought after you'd said, I'll do a thing on the Legion, where we then went away and secretly, without sharing our concerns with each other, went, oh, God, but the Legion is the most boring of all the factions. And you managed to make it not boring.
Mm.
And the fascinating thing as well, actually, and it ties in with a conversation I've just had on the Google Plus group, it makes me think a little bit about how the Zenithians operated. We've got no idea how many were on the Zenith when it arrived, but compared to the millions of people that they're about to meet in the Third Horizon, it's a tiny, tiny proportion.
It is, although I'd potentially argue that there probably weren't millions of first come. You're probably talking low millions at the most across the
horizon.
Okay,
hundreds of thousands still, but how many people do you think were on Zenith?
I don't know, I haven't really thought about it, but I guess in the tens of thousands maybe?
Yeah, I think...
How many are on Coriolis now, what do we think?
Well, we know that it says somewhere there's about 600,000 people on Coriolis.
On Coriolis. And that was made from the Zenith. So the Zenith is big enough.
And that was made from the Zenith. 600,000. But we can imagine that, you know, the Coriolis doesn't require all the hydroponics and life support systems of a ship travelling through the void, because it can be supported by... Cure, which it orbits around. We can imagine as well that it no longer has the engines it needed. They've been cannibalized and the space that they occupied has gone away.
I'll give you that, Matt. Okay.
So maybe there were as many as 250,000 people arriving on the Zenith when it was whole, which is more than your initial estimate. So, but still, you know, that's a couple of 100,000 compared to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of residents in the Third Horizon.
Yeah.
How does this people that think themselves superior to the, well, who arguably are superior to a bunch of people that after years of war and isolation have kind of degenerated into quasi-medieval isolationist societies, how do they get control? They can't fight these guys unless they find allies. And it reminded me of basically what we British did in India. You know, we had less than a percentage of the population of India, and yet we managed to... And remember as well, we didn't even invade India. We didn't send a military force in. We, you know, the way we... India became part of the British Empire was through a bunch of traders, the East India Company... going in there and then hiring locals into a massive army that kept control of the population.
Although I think we did fight the French quite a lot in and around India to take control.
Yeah, but...
So there was...
But, you know,
I don't think we went there without any military kind of backup. But I take your point, though, that you're trying to make.
Yeah, but I mean, the Indian army, I think, was almost... When we decided, actually, no, it's going to be part of the empire, it's partly because we thought the Indian army... That is to say, the East India Company's private army was something that needed to be brought in under government control. And so you can see almost parallels here with the Zenithians and the Legion. They come to this place, they feel, well, they want to be protected, they want to influence this, they've got a real agenda to, you know, stamp their authority on the Third Horizon. They need local people to do it, and they find a local army.
Yeah, that's a good point. Legion. Yeah, it's I think it's a good parallel to make, and particularly, you know, would explain one, the kind of very close ties between the Legion and the Consortium right from the start, and two, clearly explain that, you know, the Legion is a first come. It's a first come faction, really, even though they're counted as a Zenithian one.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But also, there's an interesting part, you know, the whole relationship thing that I talked about, where, you know, is the relationship between the two of them as good as I think, certainly I have assumed as a GM? You know, I've just, now that I'm playing the Legion much more prominently in the Spectral Corso campaign, I've just had them pretty much as, you know, the military arm of the Consortium without worrying whether or not there was any problem in that relationship. This idea of yours, the parallel with, you know, Britain's behaviour in India, is adds to that tension in that relationship. Because actually, again, yes, you know, if they've hired the locals that they then treat as kind of lesser than them and look down upon them and expect a kind of servant-master relationship, then naturally enough, that's going to get a bit wearing after a while to the leadership of the Legion.
Isn't it? It's
going to chafe
a bit.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the Legion, after the Portal Wars, may well have been dividing into groups of its own account and fighting each other. And that there may be old enmities still bubbling under. So you could imagine that there being a third agent, you know, maybe the First Horizon people, maybe Second Horizon people, who are maybe the emissaries themselves, who might see that as a point of witness and, if you like, weakness, I should say, not witness.
I was going to say, I'm not quite sure what you mean by a point of witness, but, you know, I'll go with it, you know.
But, you know, like the Russians did within the Indian Mutiny, they might be trying to sow seeds of dissent to find points of friction between the Legion and the Consortium.
Yeah. Yeah, and that brings up lots of lovely campaign or scenario ideas or possibilities for you know, how this might go forward. And I think I'm certainly, having thought about it, I'm certainly going to try and introduce some of these nuances into the Spectral Corsair campaign. Maybe not immediately, but as the campaign rolls on a bit, I think having that kind of tension will be a really good thing and very interesting to play through. Cool.
Shall we move on to another topic?
I think we should.
I just noticed we've hit an hour on the recording and we've still got plenty of stuff to talk about.
It's because you wouldn't shut up about player character generation. I tried to move you on a couple of times, but no, yeah, I just had to keep going on. Anyway.
Keep going. We've got a lot to talk about. It's a big topic.
It is a big topic, right. Yes.
So,
Black Sheep.
Would like to present a ship design that I've made. And in this recording, I tell you not just about the ship design, but kind of how I arrived at it. If there is a problem with the rich background of Coriolis, it is GM paralysis. Almost every paragraph is a really cool adventure seed, but we know that some paragraphs will be expanded upon in future publications. For example, take the emissaries. If you only ever read the core book, the emissaries would be a cool thing for your player characters to investigate, and over the course of the campaign, the GM and the players could create a marvellous history for the emissaries, unpack their motives and desires, and imagine a mutually satisfying reason for their mysterious appearance. And talking of appearances, the core book doesn't even reveal what they look like. I was imagining something like the Vorlon in Babylon 5. Until I read the Atlas Compendium, which reveals, well, let's keep the mystery alive for your players and just say that they are, biologically at least, as human as the rest of us. And of course, we know that the upcoming first part of the Mercy of the Icons campaign is called Emissary Lost, so I imagine most English-speaking GMs are putting the emissaries to one side until that comes out. Not the Swedes, though. The Swedes are already enjoying that campaign. Mumble, mumble, gripe, moan. Then there is the Tauern incident. It's a big mystery. Dangerous enough for the Legion and the Order to work together and put aside their differences? Or are they? Fleets of ships going through the portal and very few are returning, but what is going on? I have plenty of ideas, but The Last Voyage of the Ghazali is coming out soon, and that includes a flashback to the very beginning of the Tauern incident. What if there's a really cool secret in that scenario that contradicts whatever I have already told the players? As it turns out, my players were curious about the Tauern incident, but demonstrated very little desire to investigate it. That didn't stop me thinking about it, though, and how I might give players a taste of the Tauern incident without giving them much opportunity to discover what was actually going on yet. I do have a pretty good idea about what the incident is, one which fits the arc my players are on, but it's not one I'd want to share this early in the campaign. And in the interim, given how infrequently we get to play, the Voyage of the Ghazali might well present me with a really cool idea that blows mine out of the water. So, just in case my players were curious, I had an idea for a scenario about the DeBaron Run race, where speed is of the essence, and the player characters are motivated not to linger. The race would take in the Tauern system, and that visit might well be the climax of the adventure, but the players would be too concerned about survival and reaching the next portal to worry about investigating the mystery. Around the same time that I was thinking about that possible adventure, David Reichgeld, who created the lovely floor plans for Samar's Hammam, shared a 3D modelled ship that he'd been working on and invited suggestions for what it might be. I knew exactly what it was. A black sheep, the perfect ship to compete in the DeBaron Run. And this is what I wrote. The shipyards of Darkos are known for practical, armed freighters. But the biannual DeBaron Run race, which started decades ago as a simple bet between two shipmasters, has prompted the development of specialised Class 1 portal hoppers, in which pilots compete in their own single-class race while the freighters battle it out. They are often piloted by the scions of great trading families. These particular ships are the Black Sheep 2 model, fast and manoeuvrable. Since the Tauern incident, the race has been postponed and portal hoppers like this have been mothballed. But it is said a rogue group of disgruntled pilots are retrofitting stealth tech to them and plan an illicit and dangerous revival of the race. There was no time for sleep during the DeBaron Run, so the racing portal hoppers had a crew of two. The limited accommodation was taken up by two stasis holds for portal jumps, which meant the crews took turns sleeping in their cockpit seat or stretched out in one of the stasis beds. Facilities were inhumane, with pre-packed food, a very basic shared head, and no washing facilities. Ground crews, charged with cleaning the ship out after races, were hardy folk with a very poor sense of smell. In happier days, occasional shots were taken at other competitors with a cheap autocannon, chosen because of its dreadful range and limited probability of life-threatening damage. Those preparing to take the run since the Tauern incident, fully aware that they know little or nothing of the dangers in that system, have pragmatically swapped out the cannon for a countermeasure dispenser, thinking that running away is a better option than fitting a bigger gun. So the standard model has 4 energy points, 3 hull points, manoeuvrability of +3, its signature is -2, it has 1 point of armour and 5 points of speed. Its modules include cockpit, reactor, graviton projector, stasis hold x2 and an autocannon. Its features are a turbo projector, a supercharged reactor, and it has no extra gear. Its problem is unreliable sensors, and it costs 195,000 birr. The retrofitted Tauran model still has 4 energy points and 3 hull points and a manoeuvrability of +3, but this time its signature is -3. Of course, it still has 1 point of armour and 5 points of speed. The modules are the cockpit, the reactor, the graviton projector, stasis hold times too, of course, but this time a countermeasure dispenser. Its features are turbo projector, supercharged reactor, and stealth technology. No extra gear still, and this time the problem is a slow accelerator. This one costs 205,000 birr.
It's really interesting. I haven't touched the emissaries at all in my games. I've kind of ignored them completely. And I think, you know, your suggestion...
I think most people have, to be honest.
Yeah, I think your suggestion that, you know, it might be because there is the, you know, Emissary Lost campaign coming out. That's been a, you know, it's been a an anchor on wanting to really explore the emissaries very much. But actually, even before that, I'd sort of read about the emissaries and thought, I didn't feel there was any immediate exciting stories that were leaping out at me around the emissaries. And there were so many other interesting and exciting stories elsewhere that I just went straight with the other ideas and have left the emissaries completely. And I think your point about GM paralysis with Coriolis is a good one. Only, and it might not be so much though GM paralysis, it's more of GM discarding huge chunks and not worrying about them, of the background or the context and the story of the
thing. Yeah, you're right, actually GM paralysis
to focus on something much more manageable. Yeah.
Yes. I think that's true.
But that's a really good point. Is this so? You know, we're talking here about the Tauran situation and the Kessel run. I mean, the Dabaran run that you've mentioned.
You see what I did there.
Well, I haven't seen Solo yet. I don't know if you have, but
I have. And can we have a quick sidebar about Solo?
Yeah. Absolutely. Go on.
I just want to say this about Solo. If there's anybody out there listening who hasn't seen Solo because of what The Last Jedi was like, or they don't like the sound of the robot in Solo. The robot in Solo is fabulous, by the way.
Okay. I didn't even know there was a robot in Solo.
If you're trying to avoid... the robot's played by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. And so it's, if you like, our first female robot, and she's hilarious. I love Phoebe Waller-Bridge anyway, but she's great in this. And I will say, just go and see it. It's not, you know, Solo doesn't save the universe. It's not about that. It feels more like an episode of Firefly than anything else.
Okay.
And let's face it, Firefly was really good. So
that must
be
quite a recommendation then. Yeah. So I think for me, the reason
why... I fear it's not going to last long at the cinema, so no. Go and see it quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I haven't rushed off to go and see it, two things really. One, I don't see Han Solo in the guy who's playing Han Solo from the trailers and stuff. I just, that grates a little bit.
That's a very fair point.
And secondly, I think that, you know, it's a film where you know that Han can't die, Chewie can't die, Lando can't die. And that, I don't know. I'm not sure, looking back at early Han, is what I would have chosen for the next movie. Although, having said that, I think from the trailers, Danny Glover as a young Lando is perfect. He just looks absolutely like he's Billy Dee Williams, but younger.
Yeah, I gotta say, Danny Glover is brilliant, and I'm much of the opinion of you is, what's the point about looking at the early lives of these characters? Their story started when their story started.
Yeah.
You know, as you say, there's no dramatic tension in that you know that they're going to survive. So yeah, it wouldn't be my first choice if I was a producer of the Star Wars franchise to say, no. Yeah, let's do Solo. And I entirely agree about the guy playing Solo, who I can't even remember his name.
Which is in itself
indicative. But for me, there was a bit of a transformation in that this guy you don't really care about much becomes Han Solo through the film. And there's a key point which, for me, he became Han Solo, which is...
no spoilers. I will go and see it.
I don't want to spoil it. But it did. He became Han Solo. He became a good enough Han Solo. Huh. He's not Harrison Ford.
Is that the point where
he had me convinced he was Han Solo.
Right. So the iconic moment, is that when he takes possession of the Millennium Falcon, I guess?
No.
Okay, cool. Or is that you just saying no? Okay. Fine. but I'm going to go and see it. And I think any movie with Chewbacca in it is going to be worth seeing. So I definitely want to see it for Chewie as well. But
They've got a different actor playing Chewbacca as well. Yeah. But he does a good job.
Well, Peter Mayhew must be about 70 or 80 now. 80 surely.
Something, surely.
Yeah. So fair enough. I think, you know. Maybe they should jump forward and do a story of Chewbacca when he's a really old man, and then you could have Peter Mayhew playing him again.
going a bit more slow, we're going to have to jump forward 200-300-400 years, aren't we?
Yeah, well, that might not be a bad thing though, but anyway, there's some digression there. So
I think we might have proved there's not much to say about the ship that hasn't been said, unless you've got any other comments you'd like to add.
No, not really. I mean, it looks like a really cool little thing. I mean, I am for the Spectre Corsair. I designed a Class 1 ship called a Scimitar, which is effectively a torpedo fighter, which was chasing down the Spectre Corsair at the end of the first campaign. So it's actually quite fun designing small Class 1 ships. Maybe I'll work that up and tell everybody about that one next time round.
Yeah, I think you should, because I quite enjoyed the, you know, setting yourself the limits of what can you do with Class 1 that isn't just a, you know, glorified grav bike. So I'd like to see that.
Yeah, cool. Excellent.
And I guess that brings us on to the Spectral Corsair campaign.
It does. So we're now into Season 2 of Spectral Corsair. The campaign has changed slightly. You will all remember... I'm trying to think. How far did we get last time? We did finish the first campaign, didn't we?
Yes.
So they'd managed to escape from Odacon by going through the new portal. They'd ended up right on the other side of the horizon in Melek. And because whilst they'd been 3 months in portal space for that jump, the Legion had started war against Zalos. And so because they were in a Zalos ship, they were picked up by a Legion warship when they came out of the portal. And they were then convinced, largely with an offer they couldn't refuse, to help the Legion effectively as agents and help the Legion win the war against Zalos, because none of them like the Order of the Pariah very much. So this scenario, the war grinds on. Zalosian forces have been bottled up in their own system, but the conflict itself has reached pretty much a military stalemate. The only place that the Zalosians can operate unhindered outside of Zalos is actually on Coriolis itself, through the Samaritan Sanatorium, which is the charitable institution largely run by the Order of the Pariah, which now remains active, still continuing its charitable works. But the Legion have tried to have it shut down, but the Coriolis Council have said, no, it's a charitable organisation, there's nothing going on here. So Hanbal and the crew were given their first mission by their Legion handler, Castellan Rahul, and she sent them to go to Coriolis to investigate the activities of the Zalosian people who are working as she's saying, under the cover of this charitable organisation. And they were given a contact who has been doing some work undercover already to go and meet a tobacco dealer called Sadida Tamin. And she would be able to give them the latest briefing on what she's learned, and they're then to take over the investigation. So they then return to Coriolis. And the way I ran this, because they were in Melek, they were on the far side of the horizon, I fell to the temptation of hand-waving the travel a little bit. So I had them placed in stasis on board the Legion ship, and the Legion ship took them all the way to the CAF system, which is one jump from Kua. And they were then left in orbit around the star, and then they were brought out of stasis. So they found themselves in CAF, waiting to take up their mission and go up to Coriolis. And I think that was the right thing to do, because we've done a lot of the travelling, getting work to do all that. But it's quite funny, actually. The first thing they said when they came out of stasis and realised where they were was, right, what jobs can we get to make some money for our jump to Coriolis? So you can't take the trader out of these guys. So, but that was good. That was fine. So they got themselves a bit of work. So they then went to Coriolis. Now Coriolis is Coriolis. It carries on despite the conflict that's ongoing. And as a multicultural location, you've got the people from Zalos, the people from the Order of the Pariah, going about their business largely unhindered. On their way to Coriolis, they were obviously conscious that they hadn't spoken to Jubal, their patron, in quite a long time. Now, the Legion had kindly, very kindly, paid up 3 of their payments for the ship, but obviously these payments were going to have been late, and they still owed another payment. So they were concerned about how, one, Jubal was going to react to their effective disappearance, but two, the news that they were going to bring him wasn't going to be the news that Jubal was after, namely that they hadn't managed to get his brother back. Bressam had been killed, and then his body, which they were trying to bring back, had been sucked into space when they'd left it in the cargo hold, and the cargo hold took a critical hit when they were escaping from the asteroid. So they basically had no evidence, really, of Resim, because he was lost in deep space somewhere. So they tried to get in touch with Jubal, but they got no response. So anyway, they carried on with their job. They had a job to do. So they went and found Tamin, and she gave them information on 3 suspects who were working from the sanatorium. One was called Sister Mariam, who was in charge of the lepers and the other untreatable people who were staying at the sanatorium. And she travels down to the cellar every day, very frequently, in Coriolis, ostensibly to go and find people who need help and bring them back to the sanatorium. The second target was a man called Brother Asculum, who was a humanite from Zalos B, the same kind of humanite as Osgar. So could kind of like a reptilian, could breathe underwater, humanite. And he walks the ring on Coriolis, and he's helping homeless people and is seen there frequently and is very well known. And the third one was a man called Robart Alfaco. Alfaco. I during the game, I kind of thought, is that a hint, an unconscious hint to what he's up to? Calling him Alfaco kind of seems a bit obvious. But anyway, he's not a missionary. He's a negotiator. And he travels up to the rich levels of the spire to negotiate on behalf of the sanatorium to make sure it doesn't get closed down. But before they could plan to go for any of these, they decided to have a little bit of R&R when some beautiful women approached them in the tobacco house. Now, kind of inevitably, these were agents for Jubal. And they introduced a tobacco into their hookah that most of them just freely smoked that paralysed them all. So they could speak to them about Jubal's disappointment and about the the fact that Jubal was very displeased with them, and the fact that Jubal was very upset that Resim was dead, and they gave them one opportunity to try and assuage Resim's anger at their failure to complete their mission, which was they need to download and give to Resim all the research they had on the portal that Resim had been conducting in Oticon. Now, they don't have that readily to hand. I think they think they do, but the Legion has taken control of that information, so they don't actually have it. I think maybe they don't know they don't have it, so when they listen to this, they'll now know that. But we're playing next week, so it's kind of, it's shouldn't be too big of a disclosure.
Not too much of a spoiler.
No.
So see how long we take with the editing.
Yeah, exactly. So they've given themselves a bit of a problem there, which, I mean, I think they feel a bit hard done by, because they've actually tried to do everything in good faith, but none of it's worked out, and the roll of the dice meant that Resim was sucked out into space. So they're feeling a bit, the icons are like shitting on them a little bit, they feel like. But anyway, they decided to go and investigate Brother Asculum, being the easiest one to get to. They had a nice little plan where Osgar decided to pretend to be homeless. And being a Zalos B humanite, they obviously immediately have something in common. So that worked quite well. And they managed to follow Brother Asculum to a tabak house, a real dirty den tabak house in the streets of the ring, where he was using Opor. And it turns out that he's addicted to Opor. And he's genuinely trying to help people, they think. So they've made the assessment that he's genuinely trying to help people. He's not a agent or a spy working for Zalos here. And in their discussion with him, and some very, very good manipulation roles, they've managed to convince him that what they're trying to do in preventing Zalos from doing bad things and stopping the war is something that Brother Asculum should support. So they now have managed to get themselves an agent inside the sanatorium in the form of this Brother Asculum, which was something I hadn't thought about at all when I was setting up the scenario.
Mm.
But that's worked out really well for them. And good use of Osgar's mystic powers, his telepathy, and some very, very good manipulation roles has put them in a really good position. And that was where we had to draw the line on that last game. So their next target is going to be Sister Mariam. They want to go and see what she's up to. And that will be the start of the next scenario.
Cool.
So, yeah.
So they have transformed themselves from traders into agents.
They have, yes. And that's
and
been
did
quite...
that happen as a conscious choice, or is the story taking them there, or did you pause the story and say, well, what are you now? Because I think we're going to be having this discussion next time we sit around a table and play.
No, it was a bit more...
How did you handle that?
It was an evolution rather than a revolution, shall we say. So as they reached the point where they were being given this ultimatum by the Legion, effectively, either help us end the war, or as Zalosians, because you're in a Zalos-flagged ship, you're going to spend the war in a internment camp somewhere. And they felt, okay, we don't like Zalos very much anyway, so we're happy to cooperate with the Legion on that one thing. You know, they're not agents for the Legion generally. And that became clear in the scenario before the last one, which I ran a little scenario with three of the guys on effectively a test mission for the Legion, and it became really clear that they were not prepared to do the Legion's bidding unless it was directly relevant to ending the war against Zalos. And that was really good. That was a really good bit of play that uncovered the players' take on how they were seeing their group forming up now as agents under the Legion. So, but they did decide effectively that, yes, we are becoming agents now as a result of the circumstances that they were placed in. I've allowed them to change their group concept, so their group talent, and they've taken the friend in every port talent, which is a really good one for role-playing. I like that
great
one.
Great talent, yeah.
I'm not sure...
Not just for players, but for GMs.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'm not sure I've made the right decision as the GM there, but we'll see how it plays out. Because they, I remember our conversation about this last time, the idea that they've changed their group concept doesn't mean, though, that wipes out the history of their previous group concept. And so it doesn't necessarily mean it wipes out the previous group talent. And I've allowed them to change it. I'm not sure that's the right decision, but we'll see how it plays.
Yeah, it's interesting. But what the impression I got from what you just told me is the style of play has changed. It has changed from, if you like, a sort of Firefly-esque muddling through and getting in deeper than I wanted to an investigation style of play. You know, they have become investigators.
So yes, yeah, yes.
You know, and it's, as we talked about last time, you know, the choice you make as a group concept, I think, does kind of inform the GM the sort of game you want to play. And it appears that they have done that, and they're now playing a different sort of game. It doesn't wipe out the history of their characters.
Yeah, it's sort of yes and no, I think, though. I think yes and no, because I don't think that the actual look and feel of the game will change very much, because in the first campaign they had an overarching mission which wasn't a trading mission, and they traded their way to complete that mission. For this campaign they're going to have an overarching mission which isn't a trading mission, but they will probably trade their way across the horizon in trying to achieve that mission. So I think it'll probably feel very similar, even though this particular scenario is very much a is very much an investigator style scenario, right. An espionage style scenario. So I think it will change it a little bit, yes, because I think there will be smaller missions that they will, if it goes the way I'm sort of imagining it, there will be smaller missions that they will complete, which will take two or three scenarios each probably, but then they'll have to trade their way to do them as part of an overarching sort of strategic mission, which will play out across the campaign.
Okay, I think we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, hopefully
just
work.
One more question on that.
Yeah.
How are you dealing with the, if you like, core book canon that the Legion and the Zelossians appear... Obviously, we don't know much about the Tauan incident, but they appear to be cooperating in dealing with the Tauan incident. Has that come up? Has that clashed with your nascent war?
So your two questions there, the answers are no and no. So
right, okay.
I totally
guess if it hasn't come up, it won't have clashed with the story.
No, I'd totally forgotten about the Tauan incident until it came up in your piece just then. I think in my Coriolis universe, the war has meant that in Tauan any cooperation has ended, and I think the Legion have tried to wrap up and destroy where they can't control the Zelossian ships that were still remaining in Tauan. I could see actually a really good moment where the Zelossians don't realise the Legion are about to go to war with them, and the Legion have made some cooperative mission with the Zelossians and then turn their guns on the Zalos ships. That'd be quite cool. So I think that's what's happened in Tauan. Yeah.
That could be fun. Okay. Cool. I just want to say a little bit about, I haven't got a campaign log to give you, but I do just want to tell you a little bit about a really interesting conversation that I mentioned before. A couple of nights ago, we were halfway through the last session of our Dungeon Crawl Classics adventure that we've been having when the GM had to take a phone call and had to spend, I don't know, a good 20 minutes, half an hour, I think, away from the table.
Yeah.
And one of my players, who will be one of the players when we start the Coriolis campaign, said, "Oh, you know, let's talk about our group concept." And I think I'd mentioned to you earlier and on this podcast that they had discussed some sort of Inquisitor type thing. One of the players, not Sophie, yeah, who'd brought the conversation up this time.
Witchmellers.
Had discussed.
Witchmellers.
And you were quite keen on Witchmellers. That's not where we've gone. So one of the things I would go, yeah, we like Inquisitors. We like, you know, we'd like to be the ultimate authority around the universe, making the law. And I said, oh, well, you know, you might not be Zelossian then, because they have ultimate authority around Zalos.
Yeah.
But it's the Church of the Icons. You know, we could create. Yeah, I'm convinced that there's probably some Inquisition type thing in the Church of the Icons. It'd be a bit more like probably be a bit more Protestant. I don't know. You know, we could do that. And then they went, oh, no, we want some fearsome ship. I said, oh, well, the Zelossians, right? You know, they paint battle scenes on the outside of their ship. They went, oh, that's not fearsome enough. Well, I want I want the ship to be made out of dead bodies. And I was going, well, that sounds like some sort of cadaver clock, but you'd have to be the Nazarene sacrifice to do that. And he went, ooh. I said, but the Nazarene sacrifice is a legal organization that's totally wiped out by the Zelossians. And they went, but we could be secretly Nazarene sacrifice missionaries undercover of the Church of the Icons or something like that. I said, well, you can't have dead bodies on the outside of your ship. Yeah, but we could have, like, a chapel on the inside of our ship with secret...
dead bodies in it.
Like a lever you turn down and it takes you to a secret door to the proper chapel, which is full of, like, these dead bodies.
Excellent.
And so that appears to be what we're doing. They're going to be a kind of Nazarene sacrifice secret mission trying to pull together all the last remnants of the Nazarene sacrifice and find their relics and find their cadaver clocks. That appears to be the concept we're working with.
Excellent. I like that.
I thought you'd be really interested in that, partly because of the arc that your character's on.
I was going to say, can Yaffa have a berth on the ship?
Yeah.
He might need a new job.
Well, very possibly. Or maybe you could be their patron. Maybe we could put it a few years before. But anyway, I thought we ought to.
I think that's a great idea. Yeah, go for that. Yeah, put it a few years ahead.
We ought to bash our heads together. I know you've written a bit about Nazarene sacrifice before, but yes. I'd like to just, you know, pull together everything you've been thinking about the Nazarene sacrifice here, because I think there's some great storytelling opportunities.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I think everything I wrote on Nazarene sacrifice is on my blog rpggods.org.
Cool.
So you should be able to find it
Link them to that.
Yeah, but if not, I mean. I'll root out some other stuff if I've got anything that I haven't published. But I think there should be stuff on there, I reckon.
Cool. And you know, I mentioned as well that in the campaign, you know, you'd stolen that book, the Soliloquy and Sacrifice.
Yes.
The guys who played at Dragon Meat had decided that the best thing to do about it, I'm convinced this was the wrong decision, but they decided it, so I'm going to stick with it, is to make copies of the book and distribute them around the first. So
yeah, they're doing my job for me. Excellent.
Yeah, I mean, these copies won't be written on human skin. They love the idea of books on human skin, by the way. So it's going to be quite a sick and quite a dark adventure. Maybe long. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, but I think that's the thing with it. If you're playing a Nazarene sacrifice character, it's a bit like my character in L5R, Moshi Azamuku, who, as a player, you know, is doing some bad stuff, but as a character, you don't really.
Well, I do now, don't I?
only because of Cooney's accusation, which I totally deny.
Somebody's been accused of it.
I did think, actually, what I should have done was challenge him to a duel for that insult.
At that moment, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I shouldn't have just...
I think there's...
I should have just acted as a second. I should have challenged him to a duel because of the besmirching of my honour.
But there's a really good tension because I thought, well, you know, what do I do now? And I think what I'd do, you know me, my character would probably challenge you to a duel. But of course, I can't challenge you to a duel.
On the basis of Cooney's accusation, who's a self-confessed Mayho user.
If Cooney is is right. You've been lying to us for the whole adventure. But anyway, don't worry. It's not going to happen. He can't challenge you to a duel for two reasons. One,
he's already got one duel to fight.
You are a Shugenja, so you know he can't fight you. He can only fight a champion that you appoint. That's one reason. But the other reason...
I would appoint you as my champion.
Yeah, I'm sure you would.
You just have to commit Sabuku there and then.
But the other thing I've done is I've just written to my Daimyo asking if I can challenge the Emerald Champion to a duel, which I am surely going to lose. Therefore, I can't be D'Artagnan. I can't start going around challenging everybody to a duel. So you have got, at least until the Emerald Champion situation is sorted,
prove my innocence.
To try and convince me that you have nothing to do with the matter.
Although, I mean, you know, innocent to proven guilty, surely. Yeah, and an accusation from a
this is feudal
from a
Japan.
Known criminal. No. Well, when I went down that road with my original plan with Moshi was that I was desperately trying to resist the influence of Meiho and you know, it was about my inner battle to overcome my demons. When we came across Kuni, and I quite early on identified him as a Meiho user. I then thought, okay, I can learn some stuff from him. And then I thought, right, I'm going to become the Emperor. This is me wanting to kind of take power. Not the Emperor as in Palpatine, not the Emperor of Rokugan, because, you know, that wouldn't be possible. But
yes.
So my view changed. But when my view changed, I realised that there was likely to be a moment where I'm going to be slaughtered. And it might be sooner rather than later. But it would be fun getting there.
It will be fun. But I guess when we start talking about Legends of the Five Rings, it's time for us to say goodbye to our listeners.
Yes.
Now, I didn't give you the Legion as homework last time. You took that task on yourself. But have you got some homework for me?
I have. Well, you've been talking about the Church of the Icons. So I think...
All right.
You should do us a little piece looking more deeply into the Church of the Icons for next time.
Okay, that's a deal. We'll do the Church of the Icons next episode for our faction of the episode.
Have we got anything else
we want to say to our visitors? Our listeners?
Okay. And I'll just say that next time I will also pull up the stuff for the Scimitar Class 1 torpedo boat and see and talk about that a little bit. But otherwise, no. So I think it's probably overdue to be goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
And may the icons bless your Nazarene sacrificing horrible nasty players.
May the dancer bless your... May the beast? May the beast dancer. I don't know.
It's the beast. It's not the dancer. It's the beast.
It is the beast. But the beast is an aspect of the dancer.
May your sacrifices to the beast be beastly and horrible.
And productive. I'm sure there's a reason for it. And I did say to these guys are the bad guys. And I said, yeah, but we don't think that. We think we're the good guys. So they're thoroughly bought
in. Excellent. I look forward to hearing more about the beastliness.
Look, we haven't... Yeah, and look, the theme music's...
Bye.
See you next time.
Yeah, bye guys.
You have been listening to The Coriolis Effect, presented by Fiction Suit with the RPG Gods, with music by Stars on a Black Sea, used with permission of Free League Publishing. Imagery from NASA and the Hubble Space Telescope, brought to you by Wikimedia Commons. Typeface is Code by Font Fabric.